The scandal known as Pizzagate made child trafficking and pedophile networks a household topic to potentially millions of people who wouldn't have otherwise looked into it despite the work of investigators, documentary filmmakers, and radio projects reporting on it, not to mention the vast internet resources. Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal, a story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal, joined me at the Brooklyn Commons for a two-hour interview earlier this year, and it was simulcast during drive time on WBAI. The case of the child abuse and interstate child trafficking in Nebraska was retold in the context of the Pizzagate controversy because many are more tuned in to the numerous underground child trafficking and abuse networks. Not only is this topic difficult to fathom, but many don't want to think about how a vast network of adults harm children for their own wicked, lurid, and selfish ends. Regarding Pizzagate, Nick Bryant says, in order for an official investigation to begin, a victim needs to come forward. Meanwhile, the online investigations into Pizzagate are running deep into many categories and into the lives of those allegedly involved. This is a topic we'll continue to monitor on this show. A lot of information that goes into the investigation of Pizzagate is found on the website forum vote.co and Steemit, and vote is spelled VOAT.co. While the level of citizen journalists swarming around this topic is overwhelming, factoring in the cases such as the Franklin scandal and related first-hand accounts add a valuable perspective. Specifically, a perspective on the generations of blackmail through the use of child sex abuse practice and escort services. The recently published book titled Confessions of a DC Madam, The Politics of Sex, Lies, and Blackmail by Henry Vinson and Nick Bryant relays the story of Henry's time running the largest gay escort service in Washington, D.C., and his experiences interacting with VIPs within the U.S. government. Blackmail as a control mechanism within high places of government are one of many aspects revealed by the authors Henry Vinson and Nick Bryant. Nick Bryant has been writing and researching about pedophile networks for the last 14 years. He joins me once again on In Other News. Nick, welcome back to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be back with you, Jeff.
Your book opens with the author finding out about the DC Madam that most people are familiar with, who was ultimately found dead in her mother's aluminum shed in Tarpon Springs, Florida. Now, before we get into Henry Vinson's story, would you please tell us about the case of Deborah Jean Palfrey?
The Department of Justice came after Deborah Jean Palfrey with multiple RICO indictments. She was looking at many, many years in prison for simply running an escort service. And she decided to fight the Department of Justice. She had a printout of numbers, all the numbers that had used her escort service over the years. And she conscripted ABC to find out who these numbers belonged to. And ABC ultimately decided not to do it. They said that the numbers went nowhere, even though it's since come out that Deborah Jean Palfrey was providing escorts to at least one senator that we know of, and many people that were very high up in the Bush administration, the second Bush administration. So Deborah Jean Palfrey decided to fight City Hall, and she ended up killing herself. Before she killed herself, she said that she would never commit suicide. That's why a number of people are very skeptical that she, in fact, killed herself. But her case went through trial, and she did lose. She ended up getting a number of years in prison. So it's kind of an enigma of, was she determined not to go back to prison again, or was there some facet of the case that didn't make it into court that she was willing to unfurl? That's something that we just don't know.
That's the DC Madam, Deborah Jean Palfrey, that many listeners know about. Would you describe who Henry Vinson is for listeners, please?
Henry Vinson ran a gay escort service in Washington, D.C. in the 1980s. And he was called a quote-unquote DC Madam by the media. So Henry was a D.C. madam years before Deborah Jean Palfrey became a D.C. madam.
In the book you co-authored with Henry Vinson, titled Confessions of a D.C. Madam, could you take us through some significant parts of Henry's early experiences before he started working at a funeral home in West Virginia and then Washington, D.C.?
Henry was a very shy kid, very effeminate, and he grew up in rural West Virginia. His mother was very religious, and his father was a drunkard. Henry had a very traumatizing childhood, given the dynamic of his mother being very religious and his father being very violent and a drunkard. And he was sent to a elementary school, and right next to the elementary school was a church. How Henry became fascinated with death care and ultimately aspired to be a mortician was the principal of the school didn't like to see memorial services at the church that were sparsely attended. So if there was a memorial service that was sparsely attended, he'd march in everybody from the school to fill up all the pews in the church. So Henry, as a kid, attended numerous funerals. And there was a funeral director that inspired Henry ultimately to become a funeral director. He was very deft and dapper and very compassionate. And these are qualities that Henry didn't have in his life, but he saw them in this funeral director. So that ultimately inspired Henry on a course to become a funeral director. And he went to the Cincinnati School of Mortuary Sciences, which is a very acclaimed mortuary sciences school. And then he came back, and he was a funeral director in West Virginia, and he found it very, very difficult because he was gay, and he was discriminated against, and ran into it like a political buzzsaw there. And he ultimately packed up all his possessions and moved to Washington, D.C. to seek his mortuary fortunes in the capital of the United States of America.
You know, I didn't know he was discriminated against. I remember reading this problem he had with this other funeral home that went up against him, sort of sabotaged him.
A lot of that was driven by the fact that Henry was gay, and we're talking about very religious, zealous people. And I think if Henry had not been gay, there wouldn't have been such a concerted effort to crush his business in rural West Virginia.
Well, Nick, can you please tell listeners how you found Henry Vinson, and then what are some of the people and events that intersect with your book, The Franklin Scandal?
I was researching the Franklin scandal, and Lawrence E. King ran an interstate pedophile network, and his partner in that was Craig Spence, who was a Washington, D.C. power broker. And Craig Spence spent about $20,000 a month on escorts from Henry's escort service. So I knew Henry had dealt with Spence, and then I was also told that Henry had dealt with both King and Spence. So I wanted to talk to Henry, and I cultivated him as a source. It took quite some time. It took a couple of years.
Wow.
And he ultimately gave me an interview about how, from his perspective, King and Spence ran this nationwide pedophile network. And he also talked about how blackmail was used. Craig Spence lived in Washington, D.C., and he owned a party house that was wired for audiovisual blackmail.
Oh, interesting. This book is an extension of the research that you did for the Franklin Scandal book.
Yes. The Washington, D.C. section of the Franklin Scandal gets into Henry's story, and it talks about King and Spence in Washington, D.C. Confessions of a D.C. Madam is basically a close-up of this chapter. The camera comes in close, and instead of looking at Washington, D.C. from 5,000 feet it comes in and looks at Washington, D.C. from about 100 feet.
So Henry finds himself in Washington, D.C. because he gets a job at a funeral home chain. And then he visits a gay nightclub, falls for one of the dancers. What happens there?
Well, Henry had been, given that Henry grew up in rural West Virginia into a very religious family, he had to completely quash all the vestiges of his sexuality. And when he ended up in Washington, D.C., he decided, you know, that he was going to kick down the closet door and just come out as a gay man. And he found a couple of morticians that were gay, and they would go out to a club after the workday and party. And this club had, like, what would be the gay version of Chippendales. And Henry met one of the dancers and ultimately took him out to dinner. And the dancer told Henry that he was an escort, too. And Henry was very naive. He had never met an escort before. As Henry got to know this dancer slash escort, the dancer escort ultimately told Henry that the owner of a gay escort service was dying of AIDS and that he was willing to sell it. And Henry was a little skeptical. He had the money, but he was a little skeptical. Then he met another escort who said that he could make up to, I think, $1,000 a night. And that was the critical mass where Henry decided to purchase this gay escort service for $10,000.
After reading about Henry Vincent's life in West Virginia, he had a good business acumen. And so his instincts told him, hey, I could make money from this. It's legal. And so as he accrued clients, he actually started to buy more escort services.
And this is where Henry's business acumen kicked in. After he bought the escort service, he was paging through the D.C. Yellow Pages. And he called up various escort services. And escort services are generally shady fly-by-night operations, and they don't pay their telephone bill. So what Henry did was, when he would come across an escort service number that had been disconnected, he would call the phone company, and he would tell the phone company that he would pay the arrears if they would give him the number. So ultimately, he ended up with the numbers of, like, half the escort services in Washington, D.C. And that enabled his business to just mushroom and expand exponentially.
A brilliant move. Here he is involved into the D.C. escort service. I'm sure he's seen a lot.
Well, it's interesting. Henry is probably the most unlikely candidate to run an escort service just because he's a very shy, reserved individual. And he grew up with such religiosity. And ultimately, what did it for him was he had a tremendous business acumen. And once that business acumen kicked in and he started thinking of ways to grow the escort service, he just started expanding it, as I said earlier, exponentially. And he ultimately ended up with the largest gay escort service in Washington, D.C.
At this point, we mentioned that he had a lot of clients, and one of them named Craig Spence, the partner of Larry King. Craig Spence, who spends upward to $20,000 a month on escorts, I think you wrote it's about 100 sessions a month. It was even written that Craig liked to be shackled, fettered, and whipped. The escorts were not only just for him, but he was certainly indulging in the services as well.
Craig Spence was a coke addict and a sex addict, and also a pedophile. And he was just a completely debauched hedonist. Henry dealt with Spence because Spence spent $20,000 a month on escorts. Had Henry to think about this in retrospect, he never, ever would have responded to Craig Spence's first phone call. Because basically what happened with Henry is once he provided escorts to Craig Spence, he essentially made a Faustian pact. But he was too naive to realize that he'd made a Faustian pact. And when you make a Faustian pact, when you're dealing with pure evil, which Craig Spence was, you never know quite how many clauses and how that Faustian pact is going to play out. And for Henry, it played out very inauspiciously.
Nick, could you talk about that meeting that Henry had with Spence and Larry King, if you would?
Spence would call Henry to his home occasionally, and sometimes he'd complain about the performance of an escort. And Henry was always nervous when he would go to Spence's home, because Spence was protected by Secret Service, off-duty Secret Service personnel, and Spence was, as I said, he was an evil, intimidating guy. One day, Spence called Henry to his place, and he was in the living room with Larry King. And Henry hadn't met King before, and King and Spence started exchanging anecdotes about how powerful and important they were, and kind of pumping themselves up like Macy's Thanksgiving parade balloons. And then they started talking about their pedophilic perversity. Henry was just shocked. He was just shocked. And then after all this, Craig Spence started to ask Henry about, you know, where he grew up and where he went to college and about running the escort service. And Henry was stunned because Craig Spence was an individual with seismic narcissism. And Henry was surprised that Spence would be engaged in this dialogue, sincerely asking him questions about his life. So Henry truthfully answered the questions. He talked about where he grew up, where he went to college, and then he started to talk to Spence about the particulars of his escort service. And King just sat on the couch with kind of a smirk on his face as Henry answered these questions. And then at a certain point, Craig Spence got up and he motioned Henry. There was a big mirror in the living room, and he motioned Henry towards the mirror. And then there was a closet that was next to the mirror. And then Craig Spence went into the closet, and he motioned Henry into the closet, and there was a panel behind the closet that opened up into another room. And Henry followed Craig Spence into this hidden room, and he saw that the mirror in the living room was actually a two-way mirror, and that there was a camera pointed at the living room. And he also saw a whole wall of monitors. And Craig Spence started to hit some buttons, and Henry was looking up at one of the monitors, and he saw Craig Spence talking to Henry, and then Henry discussing the operation of his escort service. And Craig Spence essentially said to Henry, at that point, "I blackmail people for a living, and you know, you can consider yourself blackmailed at this point."
What year would you say this was, Nick?
86.
Yeah, for that year, you can only imagine the chilling effect something like that would have, because at that year, that's pretty sophisticated.
Yes. In the book, we talk about these really small cameras and then his monitor and how state-of-the-art it was. Spencer told Henry that CIA operatives had installed the blackmail equipment in Spencer's home. Henry concluded that the people that installed it must have been involved with intelligence, because it was just so high-tech and state-of-the-art.
You know, internet researchers such as George Webb, who talks about the CIA operations, I forgot the name of the project. Basically, they'll send a CIA agent into a country to destabilize it with $10,000. Their mission would be to make friends with the top-level politicians and throw a party, have an after-hours party, and then have everything filmed, you know, set up, bring in some underage people, for some of the politicians who are, you know, drunk at that point, and catch them on film. And even if they didn't do anything, there would be footage of them with maybe on a couch or on a bit late at night, something like that. And they would use that as blackmail. It sounds to me like the same tactic, and this sounds like an old tactic here.
The CIA has been using sexual blackmail forever. And actually, there was documentation that's come out about Operation Midnight Climax, where the CIA had safe houses in New York City and San Francisco, where they used prostitutes to blackmail Johns. Same type of setup with Craig Spence. They had two-way mirrors in which CIA personnel would be behind, and they'd be operating a camera. And also, if that's discussed in other books, too, that the CIA ran a blackmail operation in Washington, D.C. in the 70s. So the vast majority of the CIA blackmail is not going to be discussed, but suffice it to say that the CIA has been in the sexual blackmail business forever. And actually, sexual blackmail in politics is probably as old as politics itself.
And Henry writes in the book, Confessions of a DC Madam, Ms. Palfrey and I discovered that Americans have a collective naivety about DC sex scandals, believing that they are the mere dalliances and moral failings of a handful of individuals. I thought that was an interesting statement, Nick.
Well, what Henry is saying about that is many of our politicians are blackmailed. Are susceptible to blackmail. Our politicians are highly sexed alpha males. And nothing makes people more stupid than their libido. As I've often said, when libido drives the car, it ends up in the wrong garage. And we have our politicians, and libido drives their car quite often. It makes them highly susceptible to being blackmailed. And I think that we have a number of alpha males running around Washington, D.C. that are pandered to by people in the CIA or various intelligence entities. And it would be almost impossible not to be compromised in Washington, D.C. Think of Anthony Weiner, the congressman from New York City, who is completely driven by his libido. I mean, you or I could have compromised him. You wouldn't have needed a party house with hidden cameras. I mean, and I'm sure that there are a lot of politicians like Anthony Weiner running around Washington, D.C. that are quite easy to compromise.
To know that a lot of politicians are compromised, it gives you an idea of why things are the way they are at this point.
Yes, exactly. The politicians go against the will of the American public. Like the American public, just a couple of examples. The American public did not want the bailout, but our politicians did it anyway. The American public wanted out of Iraq long before we got out of Iraq, and actually we're still in Iraq. Most of the American public saw that we were just bogged down in a quagmire and probably creating an incubator for terrorists. So the vast majority of Americans didn't want the bailout, wanted out of Iraq, but our politicians continued with it anyway. And a lot of people would argue that it's special interests, but given the two books that I've written, The Franklin Scandal and Confessions of a DC Madam, I would argue that a lot of our politicians are blackmailed, and they don't really have a choice in how they vote.
Are there any cases where the politician just said, go ahead, I'm going to take the hit, go against the Department of Defense, something like that? Has that occurred, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge. If you were compromised that way, a blackmail photographer once described it to me as, you're on a yacht, and everybody on the yacht is having a great time, and when you're on that yacht, you can have whatever you want, whatever fires up your limbic system is on that yacht, whether it be drugs or any kind of sexual acting out. But if you decide to get off that yacht, you're going straight into the ocean, and the people in the yacht are going to make sure that you drown. So there's really no upside once a politician is compromised. If he's compromised with children, then for sure. But even if a politician is compromised with a gay man, and there's pictures of the politician engaging in homosexuality, if he's Republican, I mean, that's the end of him. And if he's Democrat, chances are that, you know, that could be the end of him. So it's either these politicians can get tremendous adulation and ultimately set themselves up for a great private sector job, or else they can be utterly disgraced. It's kind of a no-brainer as to which course you would go.
You mentioned the other aspect, which is if you don't play ball, then you risk being killed, even though you may be embarrassed, lose your job, but you might also be killed. Henry Vinson, when he didn't go along with some of the requests by Larry King and Craig Spence, he was harassed, and they would do all kinds of things. They would discharge shotguns outside of his bedroom window.
Craig Spence and Larry King wanted Henry to provide them with children. He was unwilling to do that. I know that Larry King was flying children in by the plane load, and I also know that Craig Spence had access to underage minors too. So that really shows there's a tremendous appetite for underage minors in Washington, D.C., if they were pressuring Henry to provide them with minors. And Henry refused to. He didn't mind providing consenting adults to consenting adults, but he absolutely wouldn't provide minors to Craig Spence and Larry King. And that's when it started to get hairy for him, because he ultimately decided that he was just going to stop dealing with them. But Craig Spence sent some heavies over to Henry's apartment, and they started shooting guns outside his apartment, and then they ultimately beat him up. And Henry got back in line and he started providing escorts to Spence and King, but they never asked him to provide them with children again. That was the line that he wasn't willing to cross.
It's very disturbing. Did you find out any additional material about Larry King? Because eventually he went to jail. I think you said he did 11 years?
Yeah, he did 10 years for financial improprieties.
But not for being involved in any of the child abuse and the child trafficking.
No, okay. Not at all.
Here we have once again Larry King mentioned to be involved with child trafficking in a separate situation in Washington, D.C. with Craig Spence. This is a very important intersection here with the research that you've done. You must have been blown away to see this guy's name come up again. I think it's very important that you have somebody else referencing Larry King's involvement with with child trafficking and child abuse.
Yes. Well, in the Franklin scandal, I had Henry talking about it. And Confessions of a D.C. Madam is essentially taking the D.C. section from the Franklin scandal and making it into a book instead of a chapter. And really, for lack of a better word, fleshing it out.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Henry's life got much worse after this, Nick. Can you tell listeners what began to happen to Henry Vinson after he didn't go along with the requests by Larry King and Craig Spence?
Well, Henry didn't go along with King and Spence insofar as providing them with children. He refused to do that. And Spence sent some heavies over to Henry's house, and as I said, they discharged guns right outside Henry's door, and then they ultimately followed him and then beat him up. And Henry also started to process credit cards, because there was a... Henry feels Tony was a CIA operative, and Tony worked with Spence. Tony suggested to Henry that he processed credit cards, and Henry started to process credit cards. And Tony provided Henry with someone, a business that he could process credit cards through. And ultimately, that business was a sting for the Secret Service, because they handle financial improprieties, there are various types of financial improprieties. So basically, what Spence did to Henry was set him up to take the fall, because ultimately it came out through the Washington Times that Craig Spence was giving midnight tours at the White House, that he was blackmailing politicians, and that he was affiliated with the CIA. The Washington Post tried to slam the Washington Times reportage of Craig Spence, but it was quite disingenuous. The Washington Times did an amazing job of exposing Craig Spence. And Henry was kind of caught up in all that. As soon as this was started to get exposed, Henry was taken down shortly thereafter, and he had to take the fall for everything. Craig Spence went on to kill himself in Boston, and Henry ultimately ended up getting a 63-month sentence in federal prison. The government came after him with a 43-count racketeering indictment. Henry was looking at 300 years in prison. He was merely running an escort service, but the government had to make sure that Henry didn't talk. So they came after him, and they leveraged him with 300 years in prison. And basically it was said to Henry, if you talk, we're going to make sure that you do, you know, that you spend the rest of your life in prison. So that's how Henry was leveraged. And he was set up with those credit cards, running those credit cards through Secret Service for sting.
Right. It was some company in Miami, I do believe.
Yeah, it was a company in Florida.
In Florida. I really don't know much about the Secret Service.
The Secret Service takes care of certain types of currency fraud, like counterfeiting. And I guess credit card fraud would fall under their purview if they so deemed it. I don't know if that's a standard operating procedure, but apparently the U.S. attorney was comfortable with the Secret Service going after Henry for credit card fraud.
But Larry King is out of the picture now. Where is he?
When this started to break for Henry, Larry King was getting in trouble in Nebraska. That Senate subcommittee had formed to look into King's illegalities in trafficking children in Nebraska. So it was starting to break. I mean, things were getting blown up in Nebraska, and also things were getting blown up in Washington, D.C. with the Washington Times coverage. So King was out of the picture, and Spence was shortly out of the picture. He, as I said earlier, he was found dead in Boston. And ultimately, Henry was indicted on a 43-count racketeering indictment where he was looking at prison for the rest of his life. And at the behest of his attorney, Greta Van Susteren, who plays somewhat of a suspect role in Henry's incarceration, Henry just decided to go with 63 months and keep his mouth shut.
I just think it was weird that Larry King once again slipped through the hands of justice here. He's nowhere to be found or heard of. Yes, he did time for financial fraud in the Franklin Credit Union. Would you say that Larry King and Craig Spence were working for or with the CIA?
Well, Craig Spence was certainly a CIA asset, and he said that people that were affiliated with the CIA installed his blackmail equipment. He said that to Washington Times reporters. He also said that to Henry Vincent. And the way that that blackmail operation was protected, I would be safe in surmising that it was affiliated with government entities. That our government, some deep, dark pocket of our government, is involved in sexual blackmail and involved in pedophilic blackmail, too.
Right. That's where I was headed with that question, and it's very disturbing. It's an oblique association, but it seems to be connected. How would they not be aware of all that?
Well, the way that you can tell government involvement by the way that the Department of Justice and the Secret Service cover up Craig Spence and Larry King in Washington, D.C., and the way that the Department of Justice and the FBI cover up Larry King in Nebraska. We're talking about grand juries that are corrupted. We're talking about U.S. attorneys that are overlooking tremendous amounts of evidence that show that Craig Spence and Larry King were pandering children. So, and then you've got the Secret Service doing the dirty work in Washington, D.C., kicking down doors and dispensing threats. And then in Nebraska, you've got the FBI doing the dirty work, kicking down doors, dispensing threats. So ultimately, you've got the Department of Justice, you've got the FBI, and you've got the Secret Service involved in a cover-up of an interstate pedophile network, interstate pedophile blackmail network. So to have that much power involved, and then you've got the corrupt grand juries, too, to have that much power involved in covering up a couple of pedophilic pimps and blackmailers, it obviously, they were either protecting very powerful people and or government entities.
Henry Vincent was indicted by a grand jury. I know you referenced it, but that's how he was indicted, through a grand jury. And that's how it's so easy to overlook all this evidence.
Yes.
And in the book, I do think that Henry mentions clients that include Barney Frank.
Henry mentions a number of clients, Barney Frank, Donald Gregg, who was Bush I's national security advisor when he was vice president, and William Casey, the head of the CIA. Henry said that he was a client also. And there were other clients, too, that were in the Senate and also in the House of Representatives. So there were a number of powerful people that were using Henry's escorts.
And you would imagine that they were probably on camera at some point.
Yes, it's interesting. William Casey, according to Henry, used Henry's escorts, and he used the Ritz-Carlton. That's where he saw most of the escorts. Barney Frank used various hotels, and also Larry Craig was in Washington, D.C. for 20 years, at first as a representative and then as a senator. And he was a very right-wing Republican. He voted against all kinds of gay legislation, and or legislation that would have benefited gay people. And this whole time, he was using gay escorts and having dalliances with gay men.
It's very interesting, and Barney Frank was going out with gay escorts, by the way.
Well, not only was Barney Frank going out with gay escorts, he had one living with him. He had a gay escort living with him, and this gay escort was turning tricks while he was living at Barney Frank's apartment, and I think he was actually turning tricks at Barney Frank's apartment.
So it's just people like yourself bringing this information to the public. I'm glad that you're still doing this, because this is what Henry Vincent went to jail for, because they didn't want another D.C. madam spilling out the list of clients and reaching the public domain.
Yes, what Craig Spence and Larry King were involved with, that had to be covered up at all costs. And Henry believes that if he'd started talking instead of taking the deal, that he would have been killed. And I have a strong tendency to believe that myself, that if Henry had started talking, he probably would have been murdered.
You're probably right. Just as you mentioned, as if politicians who were blackmailed, they come forward, they may be murdered. So it's not only the wrecking of a career, but it's also you could be killed. And the anatomy of a cover-up was exposed in the Franklin Scandal book. And here, in Confessions of a D.C. Madam, the grand juries convene and indict. But the newspapers are involved. And Henry Vincent was plagued, as you pointed out, by hurtful and inaccurate press. Can you go over again how the Washington Times, the Washington Post, and other newspapers were going after Henry Vinson?
Well, the Washington Times was trying to tell the truth on Craig Spence. And the Washington Post and the New York Times got involved. They were helping the government cover up Craig Spence and Craig Spence's activities. The Washington Post did its best to cover up Craig Spence's activities. And the Washington Post, people think of the Washington Post as like a beacon of democracy, but Washington Post has had a strong CIA affiliation since the early 60s. Its owner, Philip Graham, was the first publisher to be part of Operation Mockingbird, and that was the CIA's plan to infiltrate, or CIA's operation to infiltrate the media. And Philip Graham, who owned the Washington Post and also Newsweek, was like the CIA's point man into infiltrating other medias. And a number of CIA people have worked at the Washington Post. A number of CIA personnel have worked at the Washington Post, including Ben Bradley. He was involved in the CIA in the 50s and probably continued to be involved with the CIA. And he was the editor when the Washington Post was really going after the Washington Times to cover up Craig Spence's activities.
Yeah, I really felt for Henry getting slammed like that in the press. Once again, it is revealed how much influence this intelligence agency has on our media. You referenced Operation Mockingbird, that campaign to influence popular perception through various front organizations and the media in the U.S. and abroad. And Frank Wisner is the head of the CIA's Office of Policy Coordination, who oversaw Operation Mockingbird. And you titled one of the chapters, The Mighty Wurlitzer, How the CIA Played America. And that's a reference to a quote from Frank Wisner, who boasted that Operation Mockingbird was the maestro of a mighty Wurlitzer that was capable of playing any propaganda tune he desired.
And it's interesting that Frank Wisner and Don Graham both committed suicide within, I think, a couple of years of each other. So the individual that was running Operation Mockingbird and also the point man for Operation Mockingbird in the media both committed suicide. And I always found that kind of interesting.
Yeah, and you reference another interesting book that I have to read now, titled Catherine the Great by former Village Voice journalist Deborah Davis. And why is that book important?
Well, that book really gets into how the CIA influenced the Washington Post, and it discusses Ben Bradley's role as a CIA agent. And actually, that book was going to be published by Harcourt and Brace. And because of the pressure that Ben Bradley and others put on Harcourt and Brace, they pulped that book. And it's an amazing book. It really shows how the CIA was able to infiltrate the Washington Post.
And so they pulped a lot of copies, thousands, I believe.
Yes, yes. Because Deborah Davis said that Ben Bradley was a CIA agent, Ben Bradley wrote a letter to Harcourt Brace, and then there was other pressures put on Harcourt Brace. And after it was pulped, Deborah Davis put in a Freedom of Information Act on Ben Bradley, and it came back that, you know, Ben Bradley was in fact affiliated with the CIA. And she was able to get the book published 7 years later, but by a very small press. So it really didn't have that big of a bang, or the bang that it should have or could have, had it been published by Harcourt and Brace.
Now, I just want to go over Greta Van Susteren's role here again in helping Henry Vinson.
The Washington Post, this is kind of ironic, the Washington Post journalist suggested that Henry get Greta Van Susteren as his attorney after he had been indicted. He ultimately met with Greta Van Susteren, and she took on his case. Henry was looking, as I said earlier, he was indicted on a 43-count RICO indictment. He's looking at 300 years, and he told Greta Van Susteren about King and Spence and about their pedophilic compromise operation. He told her about everything. She told Henry that the government wouldn't come after him because they wouldn't want this their dirty laundry aired in public. But ultimately, she completely capitulated to the government. Henry worked out a plea agreement where he pled to 63 months in a federal prison, and he was debriefed by people within the government, and Greta Van Susteren wasn't there at all. I mean, she just left him completely exposed. So with Greta Van Susteren, everything that the government wanted to accomplish in Henry's case, they were able to accomplish with her as his attorney.
I think a lot of people who watch Greta Van Susteren on television may not know this about her. And now she's an American commentator and television news anchor for NBC. From Greta Susteren's role as an attorney to some of the judges in Henry's case to newspaper reporters, there's a common thread running through the lives of those involved with Henry Vincent's legal cases. Can you talk about that, please?
The people that participated in covering up Henry's case were promoted. Jay Stevens was the U.S. attorney that oversaw the corrupt grand jury that indicted Henry. And he was ultimately made an associate attorney general, and now he's the vice president at the Raytheon Corporation. And Greta Van Susteren was an attorney in Washington, D.C., and she ultimately became a news commentator on Fox with her own show, and now she's with NBC. So the two individuals that played an integral role in covering up Craig Spence's and Larry King, their activities in Washington, D.C., experienced amazing upward mobility shortly thereafter.
You see that a lot. The people get promoted for doing... you know, that kind of work. And you mentioned, it's mentioned in the book that Greta Van Susteren's father was a friend of Joseph McCarthy, and Van Susteren is a Scientologist.
Yes.
Who suggested that Henry Vincent learn about Scientology as a form of rehabilitation?
Yes, Greta Van Susteren played an integral role in attempting to get Henry brainwashed by Scientology. It's the story Henry Vincent in Confessions of a DC Madam is actually pretty mind-boggling. It's an amazing read, and I hope that your listeners get a copy of it and give it a read. Not only does it show the struggle of one man to maintain his semblance of sanity, but it also shows just how corrupt the system can be and how it can crush people.
It's so well written. It's a fascinating book. I couldn't put it down. I was looking forward to reading this in the week that I had it. Once again, Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse and Betrayal, and also this book, Confessions of a DC Madam, The Politics of Sex, Lies, and Blackmail, also by Henry Vincent and Nick Bryant. Nick, thank you again for being on In Other News and talking about this.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
In highlighting this tangent of the Franklin scandal, Nick Bryant exposes one of the many vital control mechanisms benefiting the deep state, the globalist network. A compromised political position bends to the will of whatever corporate interest to betray the people they represent. It's very possible that a high percentage of this organized blackmail activity is connected to the entrenchment of Western society being forced to suppress free energy devices for everyone, legalized cures for cancer, proliferated climate engineering, and perpetual wars. The very fact that this blackmail system is needed implies there may be political representatives with actual conscience. As mentioned in this interview, this type of blackmail is very old, perhaps going back to the Venetian black nobility. The recent rounding up of lower-level human traffickers in the last few months has been promising to many who see this action as a first step. The higher-level involvement of human trafficking connects to corporations such as DynCorp and Halliburton. In 2005, the Chicago Tribune seemed to be the only news outlet reporting on this. And now, online researchers such as George Webb are publishing more extensive investigative research on YouTube. It's worth looking into if you want to get a sense of the international networks and corporations involved. There are, of course, the many cases involving priests and various figures within the Catholic Church. Pope Francis was recently reported to consider allowing married Catholic men as priests. Is there a connection to the pedophile scandal there? Remember, Nick Bryant also pointed out how the people who helped to bind Henry Vincent up into the legal system and get him sentenced to prison were promoted to better positions. This is a significant detail to add into the anatomy of a cover-up. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Thank you for supporting WBAI and this show. See you next Monday, 11 p.m.
Massive division and debate and confusion rages on about the true state of the global climate. When you can create snow, even if it's 45 degrees, for most people, they feel there must not be anything wrong with the climate because look, it's snowing outside. And those temperatures do drop, by the way. The chemical nucleation process will continue to drop temperatures on the ground because you're creating a cold, dense layer of air that settles down to the ground, lowers the mercury, creates the headlines they need in order to continue confusing and dividing the population as to the true state of the climate. The atmosphere is warm. We have a lot of convection, and the climate engineering also, the particulates being sprayed for nucleating agents and solar radiation management. For your listeners that don't know what that is, this is a core part of climate engineering, solar radiation management. To put a reflective layer of particles into the atmosphere for the purpose of blocking some of the sun's incoming thermal energy, playing God with the weather and trying to turn the thermostat down on the planet with toxic, electrically conductive materials. Back to the lightning. Why do we have so much thundersnow? We do have a warmer atmosphere. We have now electrically conductive materials mixed in that help to generate further electrical charges, more lightning, more thundersnow, which is now the normal. So the system's been completely derailed, and
back to the snow lines, topography, we now typically see the weathermen trying to explain away why there's a warm side to the storm and a cold side, and often the snow has nothing to do with elevation.
Hälsningar från en dataprogrammerare i den lilla universitetsstaden Ithaca på planeten.